All right, well, let's go ahead and have you present the defendant's side of the case. I have reviewed the motion and the Commonwealth's responses. Is there anything you want to say to supplement what's in your pleadings?
Yes, Judge. Briefly as to the first two arguments and then a little more extensively as to the third. I've misplaced the Commonwealth's response, but my recollection of it is they didn't offer any counter arguments to the arguments I made in the motion. All the gist of their response was the court's already ruled and the ruling should stand. We believe the ruling on these three issues specifically was incorrect. As to the 804B5 argument, this is the fairly new evidence rule that allows hearsay testimony into evidence under certain specified conditions.
Good afternoon, Judge.
I cited a passage from a commentary in the motion. I'll repeat it here. The exception does not mean that every time a defendant is prosecuted for killing someone, everything the victim said is admissible. It should be applied only where the purpose of any wrongful act was to silence the witness. Since I filed the motion, I reviewed Lawson on evidence, and he has a similar passage. The objective of the rule was to provide relief for situations where a party has created the need for hearsay through wrongful actions, such as murder, aimed at persons who were expected to present live testimony. Pam Phillips and Calvin Phillips were not, I mean, they cannot present live testimony in a proceeding, in a criminal proceeding for murder, where they're the murder victims. The only way this rule could work is if the court believes, and I think the court does believe this, that because Calvin Phillips was a witness in the court martial proceeding, that 804B5 applies in this case. But even if that's true, Judge, it would not apply to Pam Phillips because she was not going to be a witness in the court martial. So everything that Penny Casey testified to regarding what Pam Phillips had told her, even under the Commonwealth and the court's interpretation of this evidence rule, none of that should have come in. As to the Fifth Amendment privilege, the second argument pertains to the Fifth Amendment privilege, and we reassert the position we took at trial and in the motion. The court had several options at the time. Joan and Elijah Harmon asked through their counsel to not appear, not testify, and take their Fifth Amendment rights. There were several things the court could have done to balance whatever Fifth Amendment right they may have had with Mr. Martin's confrontation rights. The prosecution could have offered use or transactional immunity. And remember, Judge, the Commonwealth wanted them to testify as well. If that were, or they at least said they did. If that were true, they could have had that testimony available by offering use or transactional immunity. The court could have required the witnesses to take the stand and assert their rights to particular questions. I was not really part of the argument at the bench during the trial, but I've listened to the argument since then. And I've reviewed the cases that were cited during that argument, and I don't believe they stand for the proposition, especially Young v. Knight, which seems to be the principal case relied on. They don't stand for the proposition that the two witnesses don't even have to appear and don't have to testify at all. So we believe that ruling as well interfered with Mr. Martin's constitutional rights to a fair trial.
All right.
As to the prosecutorial misconduct argument, I hesitated to use that phrase at the beginning, but the more I've reviewed the closing argument of the Assistant Attorney General, I'm now convinced it was the right phrase to use. Judge, the whole closing argument was one misstatement of fact after another. Some were minor, like the distinct odor of kerosene at Rosetown Road that Detective Smith allegedly smelled in the face of a lab report from their own chemist who said there was no trace of accelerant found at the scene. Another smaller, minor point that was argued in closing argument, Ms. Whaley said Major Garrett referred to Cal Phillips as a critical witness in the court martial. In fact, though, Judge, on cross-examination, Garrett was forced to admit that Calvin was just a chain of custody witness, and further, every piece of evidence that required Calvin's testimony was actually introduced at that trial. So the effect of his unavailability for that trial did not change the course of the trial at all. Other misstatements, though, were much more crucial, Judge, and I listened to this closing argument. I asked for a copy of the proceedings from the clerk, and I listened to the entire closing argument a few days ago and made notes. There was a, excuse me, Judge. One of the main misstatements that was just a blatant untruth. This is an exact quote from Ms. Whaley. The guns that caused these deaths were all found in Christian Martin's house. Judge, that was a complete mischaracterization of the testimony of three witnesses. Leah Collier for the prosecution, Scott Doyle for the prosecution, and Eric Warren, who was a defense expert on in ballistics. Now, Scott Doyle testified, or he identified the .45 caliber shell casing that was found on the back porch months after the murders as having been fired from Mr. Martin's Glock, as did our expert. But none of the three experts could identify the projectiles as having been fired from that weapon. The prosecution, in her closing argument, argued that Leah Collier said any one of those .22 caliber weapons could have fired those rounds that killed Pam and Ed. That is not what she testified to. What she said was that she could not identify any of the weapons as having fired the rounds, nor could she exclude them. But she came nowhere near saying any one of those weapons was the murder weapon. And furthermore, when Collier examined the projectiles that killed Cal Phillips, she found the striations, we had a lot of testimony about this, to be much coarser than the striations that are usually found when examining Glock firearms. Ms. Whaley asked her, could tampering with the inside of the barrel have caused that difference in striations? And she said, yes. But when Mr. Griffiths asked her on cross-examination, did you see any evidence of such tampering? She said, no, I did not. Despite this, in the closing argument, Ms. Whaley argued to the jury that the barrel of the weapon had been tampered with by Christian Martin, despite the clear testimony that there was no evidence that it occurred. And it gets worse, I believe, regarding Mr. Matlock's testimony that he saw Christian Martin in a field near the burn site at 1 p.m. on the Saturday before the murders. Ms. Whaley said this in her closing argument. She said, the defense tried to suggest that Matlock's testimony was fabricated. His evidence was so important that they had to attack him. And that's right, Judge, we did attack him because the testimony was in fact fabricated. And since it was under oath, you can even call it perjured. And how do we know it was a lie? We know it was a lie because the cell phone data that they produced with a Cellebrite data dump of Mr. Martin's phone showed beyond doubt that Christian Martin was in fact engaged in a joint teleconference with his lawyers at that exact moment, not in a field near Rosetown Road in a yellow shirt, casing out the scene as was alleged. This is the same cell phone data that Mr. Luttrell, the Commonwealth's new expert, used to show that Martin's phone had periods of inactivity or to show that Martin set an alarm for 1 a.m. They can't have it both ways, Judge. The data is either accurate or it's not. And if it's accurate, then all they proved was that Mr. Martin's phone was plugged in and into a charger and inactive for a certain amount of time. But what it doesn't show, or what it shows, is that he was not in a field near Rosetown Road at 1 p.m. on the Saturday before the murders. As I stated in the motion, Judge, the prosecution committed a 180-degree reversal in its theory of the case between grand jury and trial. This is of particular importance in this case because we had no idea what we were expected to defend, so we filed a motion, if you'll recall, a motion for a bill of particulars. That motion was denied, and so we were left not knowing if the prosecution was accusing Mr. Martin of acting alone or in complicity with others. In fact, we never knew. It wasn't until the case closed, all the evidence was introduced, and our motion for directed verdict was granted that the complicity theory was taken away. Up until that moment, we thought we were going to be hearing possibly evidence of another co-conspirator. Regardless of that, Judge, the case that was presented to the grand jury involved heavy reliance on a report from FBI agent Horan, and I have all three copies of the reports here if the court wants to look at them, that explicitly, or at least supposedly explicitly, put Christian Martin, or at least his cell phone, at the Rosetown Road scene at the time the fire was set. And this report was based on drive test data that Mr. Horan conducted and cell phone tower pings that he studied to make such a determination. But what's interesting, and this came out during the motion of the hearing on the motion to dismiss, is that the report makes none of those conclusions, and yet that's what Detective Scott Smith testified to at the grand jury. And I quoted exactly what he said in my motion. I mean, he was asked point blank. I'll misplace the quote.
Seven, page seven.
Of the motion?
Yep.
I had the transcript attached to it, Judge. Where did the FBI say his phone was that evening? On Rosetown Road. And is that the location where the car was burned up? That is correct. Yes, sir. By the time we get to trial, Judge, well, let me go back a little. We hired an expert based on that allegation against Mr. Martin.
Yes.
Our expert totally blew Mr. Horan's report out of the water.
Yes.
So what did they do? They said, oh, we'll try something different. They got a new expert who says, no, he wasn't out on Rosetown Road at the time of the fire. He was at home. But they had to come up with a way of showing he was at home. So what they did, Judge, if you'll recall, they took selective clips of video, of surveillance video, showing Mr. Martin coming into his house after undetermined lengths of time during which he could have killed any number of people. But they didn't show the corresponding videos from just minutes earlier where he left the house. We had to do that. That's completely deceptive, Judge, and I don't believe the prosecution's allowed to do that. The other thing, and I think the most egregious thing that happened in this trial, they had to put Mr. Martin inside Ed Dansereau's vehicle because their theory of the case is that he drove it to the location where it was ultimately found. This is very important because there was hair evidence left behind in Mr. Dansereau's vehicle. The prosecution had the hair tested at the Kentucky State Police Crime Lab. Jack Reed, I believe, was the examiner, and under microscopic examination, there were similarities between the hairs found in the car and Christian Martin's hair. That report clearly stated that microscopic comparison of hair does not constitute a positive means of identification. Why is that important? Because they sent those same hairs to Quantico. We, in fact, had a hearing about this because the testing at Quantico was going to destroy the samples. The court ruled that they could do this. So they sent the hairs to Quantico for mitochondrial DNA analysis. And for every hair the FBI was able to test, Christian Martin was excluded as the source. Not just inconclusive, he was excluded as the source. We thought that was the end of the matter. We were actually shocked when, during Jack Reed's testimony, he was asked about the FBI examination. And they only asked him about the hairs that weren't tested. They completely kept from the jury the fact that Mr. Martin was excluded as the source of at least two of those hairs, maybe three, I can't recall. Judge, I think that is blatant prosecutorial misconduct to deceive the jury or attempt to deceive the jury like that. We've had a case in this very court that was reversed on prosecutorial misconduct recently, Brafman v. Commonwealth, and I want to close with a quote from that case. A prosecuting attorney has a broader duty to the public and to our system of justice than to obtain convictions. The Commonwealth's attorney represents the people of this state and in a degree should look after the rights of a person accused of a crime by endeavoring to protect the innocent and seeing that truth and right shall prevail. The The prosecutor has the duty to see that the innocent are acquitted as much as to see that the guilty person is convicted. It is his duty to present his cause fairly and not impress upon the jury any deduction that is not from the evidence strictly legitimate. This is not just a general legal duty. It is also imposed specifically and directly on prosecuting attorneys by our rules, rules of professional conduct. Judge, I think what they did was present this cause unfairly, and they, throughout the case, impressed upon the jury deductions that were not from the evidence strictly legitimate. We believe this was an unfair trial with unfair tactics from the prosecution from the beginning, and we ask the court to grant this motion and either enter a verdict of not guilty, notwithstanding the verdict of the jury, or grant a new trial.
All right. Mr. Garcia.
Yes, Your Honor. The court will rely on his plea, and that was filed by Ms. Whaley, but also just add that just a couple points, that the grounds asserted by the defendant here today were all asserted at trial, in which they were thoroughly litigated by both parties and in which Your Honor made rulings on. We sat through 3 weeks of evidence that was presented by the Commonwealth, and we believe that there was ample evidence to support the verdict of guilty. At this point, the defense hasn't added anything additional grounds for the granting of this motion. They just simply disagree with what was presented at trial, in which they had every opportunity to cross-examine and make arguments for. At this point, the defense is basically just making another closing argument. To add to the defense calling Ms. Whaley's closing argument a prosecutorial misconduct, that is a gross mischaracterization of what actually occurred. There has been no misstatement by Ms. Whaley, and the defense hasn't shown that there was. They just simply disagree with the evidence, and in which they had every opportunity to challenge that at trial. So the Commonwealth at this point just stands behind its pleading and requests the court to overrule the defendant's motion, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you. I have reviewed the motion and the response, and now having heard the arguments of counsel, the motion for judgment notwithstanding the verdict is denied, and the alternative motion for new trial is also denied. I believe the trial was fair and the result was legitimate, and the matter will now be continued to the sentencing date of September the 2nd at 1 o'clock. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May I be excused?
Yes, sir, you may. Thank you.
Thank you.